Greetings and salutations. Welcome back to the Everything Astronomy podcast. Today, we have the pleasure of talking to Ari Sandberg. She's an engineer at MIT's Lincoln Labs. She's working on the Lemnos part of the Artemis mission. She went to Michigan and studied aerospace engineering. And we had the pleasure of talking to her about many parts of what engineering and the space industry is like, from the factory floor to theoretical aspects to the wild implications of sending people and to space. We had a great time talking to her, and we hope that you'll enjoy listening to this conversation. Hi, Ari. Thank you very much for being on the podcast with us today. We're really excited to have you on and to talk to you about engineering, science, space, SpaceX. We're really, really psyched.
I am thrilled to talk to you about it. Thank you so much for inviting me on today.
Awesome. Well, a lot of the people we've had on the podcast before are more astronomers, physicists, are more interested in the maths than they are the engineer. They're more interested in the data that comes from the spacecraft and instrumentation rather than the actual design. And we noticed that you've always been interested in space and space exploration. And we were kind of wondering, as a first question, why you became interested in the engineering side instead of the more science and math side to space.
Yeah, I'd say I am very interested in both. I'm certainly very mission driven. I love contributing to missions that increase our understanding of the universe or a particular unknown environment, like one of the potentially habitable moons in our solar system. And so that's very inspiring to me. Now, on the engineering side, I've always been drawn to hardware implementation, being in the lab, building something up, seeing it come together, and being a part of kind of the symphony of things that have to go right to actually make these instruments work how you want them to. So I like being on the side of bringing these aspirational kind of data questions and instrumentation goals to fruition and actually building them up, actually working through the problems in real time. And there are usually many that come up as you're doing flight integration. And so for me, I guess it is about both, but I love the energy and intensity of actually building the thing.
And it's very interesting that it seems that you sort of chose the more engineering side of things because you wanted to be involved with building things. But for example, we know that a lot of people who are in late high school who are interested in sciences and space are thinking, well, I have, they're presented with two options usually in college. You either go the engineering route or you go the physics, astronomy, math route. And they're pretty distinct, and at Michigan, they're even in different colleges. You have to apply to different things. And it seems like it's a very hard decision to make because you don't have the benefit of hindsight of saying, I like the making things, or I hate the making things. You have no idea because you're 17 or 18 and you're in high school.
That's right.
So how did you just say, well, this seems fun, and then it ended up being the right choice? Did you somehow make your decision more informed? How did you do that?
Yeah, so I'd say there were two formative experiences I had had in high school. One was doing a data analysis internship for an astronomy department at a local university. And at the time, I thought I wanted to go into cosmology and the more abstract deep space astronomy because those questions were so interesting to me. But sitting in that internship and sitting under the buzzing LED lights just processing data, I realized that wasn't the aspect that I really felt most excited to contributing to. So that was kind of an eye-opening experience of, okay, I absolutely love what this data tells us, but perhaps I'm not meant to be an analyst in that sort of traditional way. Concurrently, I joined FIRST Robotics, which had the more hands-on aspect to it. So by the time I got to university, it was like, okay, I absolutely single-mindedly want to work on space. And based off of those experiences and that exposure to the data analysis side and the engineering building side, I absolutely was drawn more to the first robotics experience, I suppose. Now, I'd say once you get to college, you don't even have to have that clarity, though. For me, the research experiences were critical to giving me insight. And that lets you cross those borders of departments that you might be in. For example, you could, at the time, the department was the AOSS department, I believe it's CLASP now, but a student on the engineering side could go and work on a CLASP mission and be working more on the instrumentation science questions and vice versa. So anyone that has an interest in the technical side, but is not quite sure if they want to approach it from being a principal investigator scientist or being more of a mechanical, electrical, software, et cetera, engineer, you can dip your toes. You don't have to commit right away. So many of the classes overlap that I'd say you're good for a very long time to just be generally excited by and interested in these things, but not have to be totally differentiated. And even then, people change their careers after college all the time. We talk about college as being where you have to, so many people are flexible. Like, certainly the position I'm in now, I was not a classically trained mechanical engineer, but I am in a mechanical engineering role at Lincoln Labs. So everything is very fluid.
And it seems so when we talk to different people about what engineering is like, people seem to have very mixed impressions. Some say, oh, well, you know, if you studied engineering and you work at SpaceX, you're probably not, in a factory building something. You're probably sitting behind a computer drawing something on CAD or doing some calculations. Yeah. And then other people seem to have the complete opposite impression that, oh, if you're an engineer, that means that you're in the shop 24/7, wiring things and stuff like, and doing all of those things. In your experience, what has working in industry been like? Is it a mixture? Are you doing more of one, more of another?
It's a mixture, but it's very dependent on your role. So if your preference is to do more structural analysis, thermal analysis, anticipating performance and system level requirements, you could just be on the documentation side. You could just be working in CAD, working in thermal desktop, these various simulation softwares. I personally specifically sought out experiences where it was a mixed, I would say, some desk job time and some building time. For me, my desk job work is primarily establishing the assembly procedures, thinking about test procedures for what needs to be done, what are going to be the success criteria. So part of my week will be that sort of preparation. And then the rest of it, so my experience in industry was literally being on the production floor, like especially at SpaceX, when we were ramping up Starlink, there was a very fuzzy line between production technicians and engineers. And they were enlisting the actual engineers to sign up for shifts and to be working on the line, to be doing quality checks actively. Like it was a all hands on deck, build this, bring this to execution and do whatever is necessary. And at the time with, a deliberately small staff to keep things lean, that meant engineers were physically building the satellites. And so as Starlink has grown, that dynamic, there's now technicians, but it's still very, very intertwined. And so that was my experience in that aspect of industry. Now at Lincoln Lab, I work with technicians whose hands are the ones that are soldering, who they are certified. They are the ones that are physically doing the operations, but I am standing right next to them. I'm answering their questions. I'm in the clean room. I am making judgment calls as issues come up. And it is still very much no real separation between you and what's going on with the build. So there's both. And some people, I know plenty of people that prefer to be on the analysis side, and that's absolutely critical to system functionality. But there is a world of room to be on the integration and test side and prototyping side, even where you're there, you're in the machine shop, you're working with the things. Yeah. So
we noticed that you're, as you mentioned, the mechanical engineer lead. At the Lincoln Lab for your project, but it also says that you're a systems engineer. So is the systems engineer aspect similar, where you're kind of overlooking, as you said, kind of walking next to the people doing the actual work, or?
So Yeah, totally. I love that at Lincoln Lab, I've been able to have multiple distinct roles. So based off of my previous experience, I gained exposure to the systems side, which is mostly risk assessment, requirements definition, holistically looking at a mission, and for me, parsing what is necessary to actually determine whether it can function in space, like being very scrappy, being very strategic with what we need to do, what we need to think about, vulnerabilities in our system, and the best way to design and suss them out so that when we get on orbit, we can have confidence that it's going to perform how we want it to. And this often requires drawing on the expertise of actual subject matter experts on your team and deferring to them and listening to them and listening to their concerns about the system, their recommendations for the system, and winding that all together into a plan of execution. And so on that program, it's very small. There are five of us total. And I'm helping from that bigger picture perspective, but there's a mechanical engineer on the team who is actively implementing to the schedule we define, to the test program we define. We have an optical engineer that's the specialist in actually making the payload do what we want it to, an electrical engineer and a software engineer. So with that, I'd say it's more akin to a program management role. And on level one, really large NASA programs, a systems engineer might only touch requirements. It might only be, here is an Excel sheet, and this is what our payload needs to do, and this is the decision risk tree of how we're going to buy down that risk. On the small team of that I'm on at Lincoln for this, that is a more fluid role, but I am... So I'm in the room with the hardware because there's so few of us. It's like us and the technician, and we're just in a lab together building up our tiny unit. But there is a mechanical engineer that I'd say is more in the trenches. Now, I am that person for this other program. So for the NASA mission that I'm working on, Lemnos, which is going to be an optical communication terminal for Artemis 2 on the Orion capsule, that is... me defining the assembly procedures, procuring my parts, being in the lab in my ESD smock and ground strap, working with the polymer, working with like technicians, working with mechanical technicians, doing the cable safety mates. So they are somewhat different. And I know there are master's degrees that are specific to systems engineering versus mechanical engineering. I've managed to gain familiarity to both via internships and research and kind of these experiences I've augmented my education with. But yeah, they're kind of two different flavors. And I really like that I can have both in my life.
So we thought that it seems the transition from here's a, you know, a textbook problem and it says like, oh, you have like such and such parameters, now come up with something, or, you know, you have a problem set that's given to you by a professor, to being on the floor and having it a good feel about whether things are going to work or not, because it seems like a whole different skill set. It's a whole new thing to acquire, because, for example, people are much better at algebra than a computer is. I mean, a computer can know the rules of algebra, but for some reason, a human being who's been doing a lot of math or physics has a much better intuition about where they want to get when they're doing algebra than a computer does. Yeah. Which is why computers are notoriously bad for sort of discovering things through algebra.
Yeah.
So how did you go from, oh, here's a textbook problem, or, you know, here's one problem in the shop, to, oh, I'm standing here and this is a weld and I think is good enough? Because that seems like it would take a lot of practice.
Yes. So I am standing on the shoulders of giants, and I have to approach many of these questions with a lot of humility and having no ego with asking subject matter experts, with bringing in as many opinions as I can, as is feasible to do, and then trying to form a cohesive action plan based off of the collective experience of my team. So I very much am still forming that, I'd say, rock bed of intuition. And that is something that I'm going to have to build up over my entire career. But what I've always, I'd say, had an kind of a natural affinity for is finding those people that really do know their stuff and can make those judgment calls. And often the first time I do an integration procedure, I'll have someone there, I'll request someone be there that I can essentially shadow or apprentice. So if I'm doing a heater install for the first time, if I'm doing a specific cable mate for the first time, I'll try to find someone within my organization that has been through the ropes and has actually been on the floor before in that capacity. And I'll go through my assembly and prep as best I can, do all of these things. But just having them there, more often than not, I'll want to address a question to them. I'll want to get their second opinion. And then usually after that, after having gone through it the first time with that kind of mentor figure, I feel a lot more comfortable and am a lot more prepared to do it autonomously. And so that for me has been the most effective way for me to very quickly, in a very applied way, learn these lessons of experience is bringing in these subject matter experts for the first time I've seen something. Now, something can be incredibly routine and a surprise will still pop up. There will be some issue you could not or did not expect. And sometimes there's not enough time to ask others and you do just try to make the lowest risk decision that keeps your options open later on. But yeah, I think it's really phenomenal that in the space industry and within these engineering teams I've been a part of, there is such a wealth of knowledge. And it's really just trying to, as an early career engineer, learn as much as I can, as quickly as I can, as deeply as I can from the people around me.
And you mentioned that your current role at the Lincoln Lab is dealing with or working with the NASA Lemnos mission. We're wondering, well, first, what exactly is the Lincoln Lab and how's that kind of connected with MIT? And is it just your team or is it just kind of motivated by space exploration or are there a bunch of different projects across science and engineering within it?
Yeah, totally. So Lincoln Lab is a federally funded research and development center for the Department of Defense. So there are several dozen, don't know the exact number, but there's a group of FFRDCs like Lincoln Lab across the country that are affiliated with various institutions. For example, the National Renewable Energy Lab, the Jet Propulsion Lab, the Applied Physics Lab. These names you might have heard of for kind of different research organizations across the country, we're all under the same category of FFRDCs. And these entities tend to be kind of dedicated research centers for different parts of the government. So JPL, specifically a research center for NASA, NREL, the National Renewable Energy Lab, is the Department of Energy, and Lincoln Lab is the Department of Defense with a specific affiliation with Space Force. Space Force and Air Force seems to be the bulk. Now, I'm sure there's nuances with where we get our grant from. So caveat, not an expert on all the funding for Lincoln Lab, but we are affiliated with those entities. And so our breadth of missions, it tends to be in alignment with national security. So it is not just space. Lincoln Lab has really broad involvement with quantum questions, with air. So we're physically located on Hanscom Air Force Base, and there is an experimental airfield and a plane that they use to fly instruments. They do undersea radar. It's very, very cross-environmental. For me personally, they recruited me because of my space background to work largely on space missions, but I'm already being introduced to one of my upcoming programs. I'll be working on biology related questions. So where that comes in, as far as that breadth and collaboration. So Lincoln Lab, we are all employees of MIT. Similar to how at JPL, they're all employees of Caltech. And so another thing that I'm not certain on, but I believe that Lincoln Lab was formed in the 1960s or 50 something years ago. And it split off of MIT as kind of this distinct entity in terms of its funding sources and its programs. But there still is a heavy collaboration between Lincoln Lab and MIT campus proper. And often there will be research programs that are uniform, that are contributed to by both entities, as in the biology program that I'll be working on this upcoming kind of second half of the year. And so that is really exciting because there's a lot of fluidity, a lot of design questions, a lot of science questions, a lot of inputs from subject matter experts across fields, very much not just aerospace. But there is a good depth of knowledge in aerospace at Lincoln Lab. So I find that personally very, you know, fulfilling because I still just love answering all those deep space questions. But yeah, so that's the general framework of where it fits in. And there are certainly nuances to it, but I will have the opportunity to collaborate with MIT campus as I transition into different programs.
And I mean, you talked about how Lemnos is going to be a part of Artemis too. And Artemis is kind of the coolest thing. It's a really cool thing that's going on. And I think a lot of people are really excited to see where that's going to go. And I think, I mean, clearly it has the potential to make a lot of people, to capture a lot of people's imaginations. So what does Lemnos do within Artemis? What's your objective with it?
Yeah, so Lemnos is an optical communication terminal. So traditionally, when we're talking about communications in space, it has leveraged RF technology. So we're using radio frequencies to transmit data, commands, et cetera, to and from a spaceship. However, in recent decades, recent years, we have found that you can do that same sort of transmission very effectively with light. And so think of that in terms of terrestrial applications with like traditional Comcast internet versus like fiber optic link. And so fiber gives you this potential to have much higher bandwidth, much higher download speeds, et cetera. So we are trying to implement that same stepwise increase in performance that you see with fiber on Earth, except with spacecraft communications. And so the Lemnos program actually includes two distinct programs under it. It includes Illumity, which is an optical communication terminal for the International Space Station to allow the ISS to download data at hopefully up to 100 times bandwidth speeds, like extremely, yeah. So I am very much not a network communications engineer. So this is a mechanical engineer trying to explain this. However, we'll be sending it to the ISS because there's historically been an issue with more data being produced than can feasibly be transmitted down in a time efficient way. And so, especially with the very limited communication windows that you have with the ISS just during passes. So we're sending up the Illumity payload to the ISS, and we're putting the O2O payload on Orion, and that'll help with science transmission data and 4K video transmission from the moon. So it's a demo to that is leveraging some previous interplanetary laser communication programs, but that will be the first time such a technology has been used on a crewed mission like this. And yeah, it just holds the potential for a lot of exciting performance improvements on the communication side for these various missions.
So, I mean, that's really cool. And I want to touch on how you guys can send information with light. But I should also mention that Michael and I, 2 years ago, or actually it was just last year, went to a lecture by Dr. Donna Strickland, who won the Nobel Prize in Physics in 2018. And she assured us, and so she won the Nobel Prize for discovering a new way of improving laser power. And she assured us that in any field of science or engineering, if you can find a tenfold performance increase, you're nearly guaranteed a Nobel Prize. So 100 times increase in communication speed is, to put that into context, seems enormous. So how do you do that? Because on Earth, you know, a fiber optic cable it sort of makes sense because you shine light through it, and because you have a cable and a shell, you can sort of send the light and choose its direction. Whereas in space, how do you avoid the light from, how do you keep the light confined to one beam?
Yeah, so at least from my areas of contribution, where we've been, the challenges we've been trying to overcome are absolutely, we don't have a nice shell. So there's, how do you Oh no, I'm sorry. how do you have your pointing accuracy? So that's like question number one. Is so like, so you need to have extreme pointing accuracy on both the transmitting end and the receiving end. Then you also have to deal with things like atmospheric attenuation and weather. You have a whole bunch of environmental parameters that are conspiring to degrade your signal and to add noise to your signal. And so that's where there's a very exciting design space of implementing machine learning and algorithmic solutions to that signal degradation that is happening as you're going through the atmosphere. So it is an extremely difficult challenge of preserving this, of preserving the signal. And we're getting a lot better on the alignment side. So that is something where Lincoln Lab has previously demonstrated that capability on an interplanetary mission. But there certainly remain many technical challenges to be solved to effectively ensure that on the ground, we're able to pick up the signal that we want and really capture the full suite of benefits that we want from this technology. But people are working on it and people are making progress on it. And both in academia and in research environments like Lincoln Lab, as well as other aspects of industry, but it's really exciting to be coming into this new discipline, because for me, my background was solar power. I was working on solar arrays for SpaceX. So the ability to, as just an engineer, hop from one area of innovation and kind of unprecedented performance in space to a totally different subsystem and now be surrounded by optical engineers where this is their life, this is their mission, this is what they're going to work towards achieving. It is so cool and such a privilege. So yeah, that's what I'm currently still very much learning about, but I've been very excited by.
Is the development of this LEMNO system, this light-based communication device, is that specifically only intended to go on Artemis to make communication between the Earth and the lunar orbiter and the lunar orbiter and the moon faster? Or is it, or is the idea to start expanding that to, for example, communicating with satellites on Mars or rovers on Mars? Because, for example, I know that when the rover that recently landed on Mars landed, it took days for the first high definition pictures to come back. Well, to make their way back because the data transfer is too slow. Is the idea behind this that we'll be able to have much more real-time communication with spacecrafts that are much further out than just the moon?
Absolutely. So this is a tech demo. It's functional. It serves a very specific purpose on this mission. We want it to work, but absolutely, when you can demonstrate a capability around the moon, the hope is that this capability can be expanded to other destinations as well. And so ultimately it'll be interesting to see how optical communications like this plays with the deep space network and how we integrate that into that sort of communication infrastructure. So there's a lot of questions, a lot of areas of growth and updating that will kind of need to happen to support this technology. However, there's a lot of momentum and a lot of excitement and a lot of innovation here. And so it'll be very cool to see how these technologies become integrated with some of our more heritage systems.
I find it really interesting how, as you've been talking about, how you're like being involved in all these different research teams and research projects, whereas at least what Joe and I are used to in like basic research fields like astronomy or physics is that people, for example, go to graduate school and study one thing, and they'll usually spend the rest of their lives studying one thing at one place, and not really kind of dip their toes in other fields and kind of connect different fields with what they're doing. But with you as an engineer, it's really interesting to listen and hear about how you've been involved in so many diverse engineering projects. And so is that something that's common as someone who's early in their career as an engineer to kind of work with different teams and move from one company to another institution? Or is that something that what you will do for the rest of your career is working on different teams, different projects?
Yeah, I, I don't think it's uncommon amongst my group of friends that graduated Michigan from me, from the College of Engineering. Many have seen many different types of projects. Generally, we've all stayed roughly in the same field. So for me, space, for some of my friends, robotics, et cetera. But the application of their specific expertise and where they're learning from and who they're learning from has changed a lot, even in just the few years since we've graduated. So in contrast to pursuing kind of a PhD route, my route of graduating with a bachelor's and then immediately starting work on these different programs in industry, I think has lent itself really well to a lot of variety. And I don't think that's uncommon. Some people do have very specific depth and a very specific niche. And that brings them a lot of professional fulfillment. And that also is super critical for these missions that really need someone that's extremely good at something and is not just a generalist. But I like to view kind of all my experiences as having this point of continuity where I'm learning to be a better integration and test engineer by seeing all of these different systems and not just kind of redoing the same implementations over and over again. I'm constantly having to think about how environments are going to differently impact my systems. What changes or improvements can I make in this new framework, but grounding it all in the previous experiences that I've had. So even though the topics are random, or at least very varied, I do try to always ground them in and becoming better at those aspects of engineering. And so far, so good. It's been really nice to see things build on top of each other. And to see kind of a clear trajectory in my growth.
One question that I often get from people who are either not in sort of STEM fields or who are thinking of going into STEM fields is, what's math like? Because I think a lot of people are like, oh no, I mean, this stuff is cool, but there's maybe a little too much math. And a lot of people don't really like math. And then they get to college and then they make you take vector calculus and diff EQs. And a lot of people, I think, are a bit thrown off by that and they don't really like doing that. And then I think you often hear the idea or the argument that, they just make you do this for the intellectual exercise when you're out and working. It's very rare that you'll ever have to use a triple integral to do anything. And you just kind of have a computer and it just sort of does those things for you. In your experience of sort of the professional industrial engineering and research, how much math do you do? Do you spend a lot of your time writing equations down on a white piece of paper and then solving them, or is that pretty minimal?
I do extremely little math. However, analysts on the thermal side, orbital planning side, et cetera, I think have it as a much more daily part of their world. Or if they're not doing those calculations themselves, having enough of an understanding of what answers are reasonably correct is necessary to sanity check these programs. Because even if you're using some analysis package, it is infamously easy to misuse those packages and to get a completely wrong answer. And unless you have a really deep understanding of what the underlying equations are and methodologies are, even though you're not necessarily doing those calculations yourself, or in all likelihood, not doing those calculations themselves, you need that understanding to sanity check your outputs. Because just treating it as a black box that gives you a magic answer can be really, really problematic. But for me personally, I'm doing a lot more of process development. I'm doing a lot more of getting the requirements or getting system information from the analysts and figuring out how we need to assemble something to meet those objectives. How do we need to qualify it via a test campaign? And so for my specific role, there isn't a lot of math, but I'd say an understanding of the computational foundations of these topics is very necessary on the analysis side. As well as the design side. I am not primarily a designer. That's also just kind of been my role so far in these programs. And I've loved working downstream with design. But with designers, you also kind of want to have in your back pocket an intuition for thinking about loads, thinking about how you'd want to structure or build something. And then you verify those intuitions via using an analysis package like ANSYS or something like that.
And one thing that I think is for a lot of beginning scientists, it's very hard to say, okay, now I will stop trying to just read more of existing things and read more papers and learn more techniques and start actually using them than doing real science. And I know that Michael and I, who are doing undergrad research in physics and astronomy, I think that we both found it, and I think especially me, found it very difficult to say, okay, now I have to stop trying to learn more and just actually do things. And it seemed like a very hard line to do. How did you sort of go about that when you first started working either at SpaceX or at Lincoln Lab now? How is that process of, I could read more about existing procedures, existing techniques, and maybe, you know, perfect your knowledge on what's already out there, to this is a good enough solution and this is good enough work that I should start working and not worry about, oh, has someone thought of this particular detail or something like that before?
Deadlines, baby. So when you're actually in industry and you have to ship, you have a launch date, you are manifested, your hardware needs to be completed by that date. Not only does it need to be completed, it has to be designed, tested, and stamped, shipped off by then. And so that puts really defined parameters on when you need to be done with certain phases of execution. And certainly things get delayed, but especially at SpaceX, especially in kind of these very fast cadence, innovation-centric companies, you want to, you know, approach your problem strategically. You want to apply best practices to the best of your ability, but at a certain point, you have to execute. And you will learn a lot from initial attempts and you will iterate on those. But so it's this fine line between reinventing the wheel, because in that crunch, you may miss a piece of literature that perfectly explains this phenomenon you are baffled by in testing. That definitely happens, but there is this cadence and this need to meet these very kind of real world deadlines that you just got to do the best you can. And so that's that gray area in between perfect knowledge and kind of lack of preparation. You're operating in that zone. But SpaceX taught me to learn a lot from actual physical kind of empirical experimentation and testing a piece of hardware. Like, you can predict through analysis or through literature all you want, but so many of these space systems are covariable, like just completely a specific study is unlikely to capture your exact environment for whatever reason. And all of these things are so coupled that you sometimes just have to do it yourself and have to see how it performs in your specific environment. And hopefully it is consistent with other trends observed by other programs, but there are very few copy and paste solutions in space exploration. And it is very often just learning what you can, when you can. But by the time it gets to, you know, especially once it gets to integration and test, you're learning from your own system and really trying to improve upon it.
And we were curious, have you ever thought of working on perhaps the human space exploration? Because Starlink and, you know, the Lemnos system are not particularly related to sending humans to, well, I guess Lemnos.
Sure they are. I mean, Lemnos is on Orion. It's literally crewed.
Yeah.
Do
you think that you may be interested in doing things that are more directly related to the survival of human beings in space? Because, you know, we know that when we've talked to some other guests before, you know, the survival of human beings is a huge obstacle in, for example, getting people to Mars. And I know that's one of SpaceX's main objectives. Have you ever been involved with that?
So the solar panel work that I was doing at SpaceX, the kind of back-end analysis of the solar panels was used partially on the Dragon capsule as well, like Crew Dragon. So often when you make an innovation on the kind of robotic unmanned side or on the crewed side, there's a lot of cross-pollination between those programs. And so right now, working on this optical communication system, going to the ISS, going on Orion, I could definitely see that laying the groundwork for having, you know, a laser comm system on Mars eventually, or if there is a colony elsewhere. Now, actual human survivability, I've always found this very interesting, like the bioastronautic problems of, you know, making sure humans themselves can survive healthily and safely, like in a microgravity environment for long duration missions. And currently I'm not positioned with the skill set to answer those sorts of biology questions and countermeasure development questions, but I absolutely am. If the opportunity arose to work on a technology like that, or on, you know, new age spacesuits, something to that effect, I would approach that, I think, with the same enthusiasm that I do any of these other like really cool space questions. It's just all very symbiotic and crosses over. Like when there's innovation in one sector of space, it helps the other sectors as well.
I mean, and that's a really cool thing with space, is that so many things are just really cool individually. And it seems like there's a lot of, whenever someone talks about a space mission, there's always, or at least I think, there's a lot of really cool components within it. What has so far been your favorite, the favorite project you've worked on, or the thing that you thought was the most fulfilling or interesting?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I mean, so far the most probably awe-inspiring thing I saw was seeing Starlink go from new concept in 2018 with a new iteration of satellite early design to 400 satellites on orbit by first quarter 2020. Like that seeing high volume production brought to aerospace when that has really never been the paradigm that it's been operating to, that was really exciting. Having the ability to test in that capacity solar panels and for me gain a deeper understanding how these solar arrays react to radiation degradation, thermal vibration environments. Like it just felt like this whole immensely cool design and trade space with a lot of unanswered questions that had just never been tried before and never been asked before. And so I really liked that, and I loved seeing them actually on orbit, and it was really fulfilling to get data down from the system in volume and be able to see that full circle, cradle to grave execution of something that I had worked on. And that was really neat. And I look forward to that same feeling at Lincoln Lab, because I'm currently working on these missions now that we are integrating the flight hardware. Some of these launches will be happening first quarter of next year. And I look forward to kind of that same, like for me, it's like when it's on orbit, like that is the bow on top, because that really tells me the quality, how we did. Like that is the answer to the question. That's the grade on the test. That is, and not that a failure is an F on the test, but there is something immensely fulfilling about with all of these uncertainties and with the overall brutality of the space environment, knowing that you have created something with your own hands that can work up there at all is just mind blowing to me.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Joe.
Please.
I was going to say, I imagine with all these successes and ribbons on top, as you said, come a lot of failures and kind of doubts in yourself, or kind of obstacles. So I was kind of wondering along, whether it be as an undergrad, or your early career now, what kind of obstacles have you come across in the field, and how have you kind of dealt with those? And I guess related, what kind of advice do you have for people who are kind of following a similar path to what you're doing now?
Yeah. There are absolutely times when you break a piece of expensive hardware, when you overlook something that you are angry at yourself for having overlooked it. That absolutely is an element of this. And fortunately, the nature of the work I have done so far has been these fast cadence kind of experimental satellites, where there is a space for learning through actual flight hardware. There is a space for something being on orbit, not operating as you want, and you still being able to derive useful information from that and being able to fly again. I've never had the experience of having a failure on a crewed mission. That is something where I am not sure kind of what that thought process is. And of course, that has so many more elements of kind of grief and emotional processing with that. But on the purely, you know, hardware side, especially on autonomous missions or unmanned missions, it's frustrating. You want to do your best. You know that so much work has gone into every one of these, but there are absolutely failures. And it's just kind of coming to peace with that and trying to make it that when those failures happen, you're at least positioned to learn from them. So that's the biggest thing. Certainly when I was doing research as an undergrad, there were plenty of times that stuff didn't pan out as I expected, blew up a power supply that had no replacement, like felt like I was backing myself into a corner. And it's just stepping back. Like usually, you know, it takes a day or two of breathing and thinking and trying to kind of unravel your emotional gut response from what has happened. But once you can get to that point, it's talking to your mentors, it's thinking through, like root cause failure analyses are super critical to industry. So you have a failure, you see a defect, whatever it is, you think about it, you breathe, and then you start, you know, listing possible causes, thinking about how you can work through it and improve your design or improve the next generation spacecraft. And you involve other subject matter experts that can give you perspective. And so there, the biggest thing is to make sure you're set up to be able to get the data you need to, you know, root cause an issue. But if you've done that to the best of your ability and you have something to work with, then it's like, okay, we can do this. We can get something meaningful from this and it's okay. But yeah, it's high pressure. And that is something that I've had to learn to work with and be patient with myself about as I've gone through these first few years.
And I mean, for example, at Michigan, we know that a lot, especially with COVID now, a lot more people are feeling the stress and the pressure of things. And I think a lot of people who are, it seems to me that a lot of people who are thinking, well, you know, I would like to do space and I think if you're in college and you decide that, oh, I want to go into the space industry, that seems pretty wild. I think to many people, it's like, oh, well, you can, you know, design a car. That seems pretty, I think that seems pretty normal to a lot of people. But if you're going into the, if you think, oh, I want to go into space, it, you need to be, you're dreaming and it's believing, it seems. Did you ever go through those moments in college where you're thinking, well, maybe I should go and, you know, not do aerospace, maybe do mechanical or CS, because now CS is immensely popular. Did you ever think that space was sort of an unreasonable, outlandish option for you and that you should try to do something different?
The only moment of self-doubt with that was not whether space was worth doing or what I wanted to do. It was whether I could do it. I had historically been much stronger in the humanities and liberal arts and writing than I had ever been in traditional STEM subjects. And in order to get good at those STEM subjects required a lot of tutoring, being at every office hour, a level of requiring levels of help that I was unsure of whether that meant I wasn't cut out for it. And so that was in high school, was trying to make up for lost time and getting a ton of math tutoring to set myself up to be successful in engineering. That was throughout my aerospace education. But there was never any question in my mind that if I could do it, space was what I wanted. And so when I was applying to colleges, I contacted NASA and asked them where they recruited from and exclusively applied there. And I wanted to do aerospace specifically because I wanted to, you know, sure, I could keep more options open with mechanical, but there was nothing else I wanted to do. Like it was just as clear as day to me that I wanted my examples in class to be about, you know, thinking, how do you improve the performance of your vehicle? How do you measure the speed of this system going through space? Like that, those were the questions I wanted to answer, not how a car was going to work, not these other systems. And so from the gate and throughout, there had been an early time where people were telling me that I would be too restricted if I chosen an aerospace degree, but I found that every position that I have received and been qualified for, you know, called out mechanical engineering as a requirement, and they didn't bat an eye that my background was aerospace. That wasn't even relevant to their consideration, because the demonstrated ability that I cultivated through research and internships meant so much more than the degree name. So I would encourage, like, that was one of the greatest myths that I was told, and kind of fear tactics that was told to me as I was, you know, differentiating and was told aerospace would be too restrictive, there wouldn't be jobs. That has just not been true at all. At every career transition junction, I've had multiple job opportunities. I've had the privilege of choice. I've had the privilege to be able to have it to an extent be on my terms, where I go and when I go. And aerospace is rich and full that way. And if you're passionate about this field, if you're passionate about space, there is an absolute need for you. And I would like to emphasize that that need is not restricted to engineering. Like, there are, you know, artists. When I was at JPL for an internship, there was a whole group of artists that were working on, you know, simulation renderings, that were working on the posters that you have behind you on your walls. Like, there is this need to interact with the public. So you have writers, you have policy advocates. There is this huge expanse of participation that is not just the technical side we've been discussing today. So if you're passionate about space and don't feel you're particularly, you know, apt at some of the STEM topics, but want to write about it, want to talk about it, want to advocate for it, there's a world of that we really need help in as well.
Yeah, for sure. I think that's one of the biggest myths, at least for me, is when I was a kid or in high school thinking about getting involved with space, I always thought of either, you know, galaxies and cosmology or rockets going to like the moon or Mars. But it's much more involved with that. And I think both Joe and I have experienced, by having this podcast and having this all these different guests from diverse career stages or careers, that space is much more involved than just those two subjects, that there's tons of people.
Absolutely.
And space needs everyone's involvement.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm passionate about that for sure.
We also know that when you were at Michigan, you were involved in science writing and communication. Is that I assume that nowadays you don't do so much of that. Is that something that you ever think that you want to return to? Were you particularly passionate about that, or have you now moved on to bigger and better things?
Now I do a lot of that, and I've continued to do that throughout my career. So when I spoke earlier about originally my passion being the liberal arts, I was a writer. I loved, you know, communicating about the importance of space. I worked in the planetarium at the Denver Museum of Nature and Science starting when I was about 13, and was a little galaxy guide in my Spock smock and was presenting the wonders of space and to students and people, my senior, like by 50 years, my elder. And that really kind of planted the seed of me really loving and seeing the gaps in understanding and the between the technical community in aerospace and the general public. And for me, it was as clear as day, like why we want to explore these unknown worlds and why there's inherent merit in this. But that was not, it was rapidly clear to me that that is not obvious to many, many people, and that it is necessary for us engineers to articulate ourselves and to communicate to others why this is valuable. And so after the museum experience, I was a member of Citizens for Space Exploration, and we went to the Capitol in DC and we were advocating on behalf of sustained NASA funding. And that was also related to the Space Act, like just trying to educate policymakers about why funding NASA, why funding Earth science was important. From there, when I was at Michigan, I interned at National Public Radio in their web newsroom, wrote about various space and general science topics, and have continued. I was the department writer for CU Aerospace Department my freshman year, was the department writer for Michigan Aerospace Engineering, doing feature articles throughout college. And now I do talks for students. So on April 10th, I'll be doing a Science on Saturday talk for MIT Lincoln Lab, and we'll be going through, you know, mission highlights of this past year and kind of drawing back the curtain on how we design and test missions for space. I've given maybe 10 talks this past year to various robotics teams, middle school groups across the country. Like, a benefit of COVID has been remote engagement like this is much easier now. And so though it's not a formal part of my kind of paid day-to-day life, like it was at some of these other institutions, I still think that outreach and communication gives our work meaning and context, because without public support and engagement, these missions, you know, will lose funding, will lose the ability to be executed. And I just also think that these are worth doing, all of these endeavors that, and all of these questions are worth asking. And the more people engaged in answering those questions, the sooner we'll find solutions and the sooner we will come to, you know, understand our universe. And so I'm passionate about getting women involved, but I'm just passionate about giving greater visibility to the field.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. And I think not only with science communication recently, but really, I guess related to that is like SpaceX and the rise of privatization totally. In space, where, you know, before I think people had their doubts in the US space program, where there wasn't that enthusiasm that, you know, we kind of romanticize about the 1950s and 60s with going to the moon. But at least in the past decade, like one of the biggest reasons I've become interested in space, and like people that I'm friends with, or even my family members who were never interested in space, but all of a sudden I've become interested in space, it's because of watching, you know, these rockets launch and reland themselves.
Oh yeah.
Or like seeing firsthand actually how engineering works, and seeing how you know, it's okay for things to explode on launch, but the next time they'll get it to space.
That's right. Absolutely. I think there has been such an injection of energy and public awareness in space from some of these private endeavors and from these super engaging mission feeds, like as the mission is going through, really explaining what's happening and why it's important. Like SpaceX has done a marvelous job. Like we're starting to see other kind of space entities also kind of up their game as far as public engagement. And yeah, I think even though NASA was doing a lot between end of Apollo and kind of current modern era of commercialization, a lot of it was robotic missions. And a lot of it was the kind of these more science bent investigatory missions that I don't think were the value of was necessarily articulated very well. And so to kind of the outside, it looked like NASA was dormant, when really, you know, NASA was sending these interplanetary probes and exploring and discovering just, you know, a bunch of things. But that wasn't clear. And there's something about these manned missions. There's something about these rocket launches. They're sexy. They're loud. They're important. It does grab the attention. And I think more, it's not just showmanship. I think we really are, you know, entering this era of extremely fast innovation brought on by partnerships between private and public entities. And that's fantastic.
I mean, it does make some sense that if you tell someone, don't worry, we're going to send this probe out and it's going to figure out this value of this cosmological constant, or it's going to figure out some fundamental constant about the universe to a higher degree of accuracy than before, it's not so interesting. Whereas if you say, we're going to send a bunch of people and they're going to walk on the moon and they're going to live there, I think that's pretty awesome. And hopefully we'll see people back on the moon very soon. And hopefully Lemnos works and Artemis is going to go well. So we've been talking for a while, and our last question to our guests usually is, what do you hope, what is your biggest hope for your field, or where, or your current projects? Where do you see these things going in the future?
I mean, my biggest hope for the field is more diverse participation in the field. I guess that's on the social side. Like as far as I look forward to not being a minority, I look forward to having teams that have more eclectic compositions, because that means we're drawing from a wider pool of talent and we're drawing from a wider pool of people that could contribute to these, you know, incredibly challenging questions. On the technical side, my dream is for us to discover life elsewhere, and specifically on one of the potentially habitable moons. Europa is my raison d'être, or whatever. I freaking want to explore that ocean. I want us to the movie Europa Report with its, you know, crazy squid creatures. I just want a microbe. Doesn't even have to be a full squid. I just want to explore some of those moons. And we have some incredibly exciting missions coming up, like Europa Clipper and Dragonfly, that are going to explore some of those environments. But if in my lifetime I could be a part of, or even just see the data from, some of those missions that are really getting in the trenches with these potentially habitable environments, that would just would blow my mind. I would yeah. I live for that. And so that is what I really hope to see. On the private side, I'd love to see continued growth with these partnerships with private and public entities. I would love to see space become an increasingly regular part of daily life, whether that be through, you know, low Earth orbit tourism, travel, whether that be through quasi-permanent, you know, colonies on the moon or Mars. That would be really remarkable, and I think is well within the trajectory of where we're currently going. So those are some of the things I'm really looking forward to, and can't wait to see evolve.
Yeah, and hopefully those will all go hand in hand and things will all progress nicely and neatly.
Absolutely. We love nice and neat.
Well, awesome. Well, thank you for taking the time to be a guest on our podcast today. We're really excited to share this with people. And yeah, thank you so much.
Yeah,
it was really interesting to get to talk about your story and exactly what's involved in your engineering roles.
Hey, everyone. Thank you for listening to this podcast episode. This is Michael.
This is Sam.
This is Tommy.
And this is Joe.
If you're listening to this on YouTube, make sure to like, subscribe, and share with your friends. And if you're listening on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, make sure to leave a review. All of the show notes can be found either in the description below or on our website. Thank you again for listening, and we'll see you next week with more Everything Astronomy.